which said that K has to go to zero at the boundary, and that gave us a boundary gradient estimate. Okay. So what I want to do first of all today is describe what happens when you drop one of these conditions or both, what sort of solvability results you get. And that's sort of going to lead us to the regularity theory. Yes?
What is the omega n?
Omega n is, it's the measure of the unit ball in Rn. I think Walter uses it to stand for the measure of the sphere. So it's not quite the same, it's very related. Okay, so that's what I want to discuss today. And along the way we'll pick up some bits and pieces about generalized solutions and some other things. So let's suppose first, let's call this say one and two, and the question is, what can we say if we drop one and or two? Hi, Robin. That's what I want to discuss today. So first of all, let's look what happens when we drop two. So omega is always going to be a uniformly convex domain. So let's suppose K is, say, smooth up to the boundary, if you like, doesn't really matter. Positive satisfies one, but not two. So then we can take a cup function, say e to j, so that e to j is between 0 and 1, e to j is positive in omega, e to j is 0 on the boundary, and we can look at solving the problem with k replaced by e to j times. That problem, and you see we've still got e to j, k is less than or equal to the integral of k, which is less than omega n, so we've still got the first condition for solvability, and we've also got the second because these are smooth, so we've got e to equal 0 on the boundary. So eta times k dies off on the boundary, so we can solve this. There exists unique, smooth, well, no, there exists unique convex solutions uj in whatever you want, say c infinity omega intersect C 0 1 omega bar, Lipschitz up to the boundary. And we have a bound independent of J, which means that we have, by convexity, we have bounded convex functions on any subdomain we have a bound for all compactly supported subdomain. So we have equicontinuity. We can pass to a limit. Uj converges to something called U, which is, say, Lipschitz in the interior, and it's bounded, but we can't, what else? That's about all we can say for the moment, okay? So this U is our prospective solution of this Dirichlet problem. Now the problem is, what can happen as these, I forgot to say what these eta's go, eta j increase up to the characteristic function domain. So what you expect is you're getting a solution of the equation up there, but something's going to happen with the boundary values. And what's going to happen typically is the picture is like this, very sort of schematically. You want to solve boundary values up here, and so you solve these approximating problems, but what might happen in the limit is that the solution, it satisfies the boundary condition in some places, in other places it doesn't, it drops down. Okay, and so the theorem, which I'm sort of on the way to proving, I've got at least, I'll explain in a minute what we've got here. We've got at least a generalized solution of the equation. So the whole theorem that I want to describe is, so if omega is uniformly convex, boundary say C2, let's say, or C11. And K is in, say, let's see, 2. Okay, so the theorem is then there exists a unique convex solution U C2 omega intersect L infinity, so it's smooth inside C2, at least C2 alpha bounded, of the equation. Satisfying that the limb soup as x goes to y of u of x is less than 5y for all y on the boundary. So this is as x approaches in the domain omega. And if we have any other solution, if V in C2 omega is a solution of is a convex solution of the same equation, let's call it something star, then, and the Lynn. I should be Lynn in. Not Lynn Soup. And Lynn Soup here as well. V. Then V is less than or equal to U in omega. Okay, so that's the theorem. So we get a solution of the equation. It satisfies the boundary condition, not quite in the classical sense, but in sort of this optimal sense. It's less than or equal to phi on the boundary in this sense. If you have another solution which also is like this, then U is bigger than that. So U is the maximal solution that lies below phi on the boundary. Okay, so U is the supremum of all the subsolutions below phi, and the proof shows that U is also the infimum of all the supersolutions which lie above. And you can see that here already, because all these UJs are supersolutions which lie, well, they're equal to phi on the boundary, so, and these are decreasing. So U certainly lies below all of these, so you get that. And the what's interesting here is, okay, so we've got most of this. The only part we don't have is the regularity, really, right? And the fact that it satisfies the equation. So now I want to describe that. So let's look at this equation again. If we integrate K over any Borel set, if we integrate the equation, we write it in this way. Well, if we have a smooth convex solution K positive, this is a Jacobian of the gradient map, so you change variables. Okay, and now if you forget about this middle piece, you just say for every Borel set, the integral of E, the integral of K over E has to equal this. Well, that makes sense just for C1 convex functions, right? And if you replace this by the subgradient image, that is the set of all slopes, if you have, say, set of all slopes of supporting planes, so this can be multi-valued, you can generalize this to non C1 convex functions, right? And so that's the definition of the generalized solution. Definition is U, which is just convex, is a Alexandrov or generalized solution of the equation of star if for every Borel set E in omega, the integral K over E is given by this. Okay. So that's the definition. And, well, you can prove various things. First of all, let me denote this by omega of U of E. So some facts, which I'm not going to prove today. Some of it will be proved in the notes. First of all, omega U is a measure, is a Borel measure on omega. So the main point you have to check here is that it is countably additive. So do I need to? I'm just calling this. It's a measure. So yes, it's a definition. I'm defining this measure. I mean, I'm defining this thing, and I'm claiming that it's a measure. It's a Borel measure. Do I need to? I mean, has everyone seen this, or has anyone seen this fact before? You've seen it. Does anyone want to see the proof, or? We'll skip that. Okay. All right. It basically comes down to the fact that the Legendre transform is a convex function, and that's Lipschitz. So it's really it comes down to Rademacher's theorem if you look at it the right way. So it's differentiable almost everywhere, and that's really what. Well, maybe I can give the proof if you want. If I have it here, I think I have it. Okay, so really, to show that this is countably additive, what we want is this, that the set of points that belong to two different subgradient images for x not equal to y in omega, but that has measure zero. Okay, so you look at the Legendre transform. And so this is a convex function. It's a superlinear function, so it's convex on Rn. And so it's differentiable almost everywhere. So now if P is in, say, subgradient at x0, then U star is P is x0 dot p minus u x0, and that really well, why is that true? Well, x dot p minus u of x is x minus x0 dot p plus u of x0 minus u of x0. And what's left over is x0 dot p minus u of x0. And this is less than or equal to 0 by convexity. And so you see, this is true for any x, the sup is attained at x0. So this is true. So, if u star is differentiable at P, then du star at P has to be x0. And why is that? That's because well, for, you see it from here, really, because the soup is attained at x0. And if that's a point of differentiability, that's what you have to have. Okay, so if this P belongs to the subdifferential at some other point, then and then du star of P would have to be x1. And that would mean that you would have two different things in the derivative, which means u star not differentiable at p. And so for almost, since u is differentiable almost everywhere, you must have a set of measure zero. That's the idea. So using that, you can check this is a countably additive measure. What's another important fact about this, which is if you have a sequence, say uj, convex functions, and they converge uniformly or locally uniformly, yeah. Yes. I mean, this is, you know, the sort of mass transport problem with particular weights. Okay, the other property is there's a continuity property that these measures converge weakly. So if you have a sequence of convex functions converging to U locally uniformly, then the measures converge weakly on omega. And that means that if you take a function phi with compact support, continuous, this is for all continuous functions with compact support. Okay? So if we use this definition here, well, this gives us a way of interpreting the equation in the weak sense. Here we've got a sequence of functions converging locally uniformly, so this limit is a weak solution in this sense. So we've got now that the equation is, at least, it's a weak solution. What's left now is to show regularity. Okay, well, the regularity, well, you face the usual problems you face in Monge-Ampère equations. And that is, you don't have the right sort of control on the boundary. So what you would like to do is, these approximating things, they're smooth, they satisfy the boundary condition. So what you would like to do is apply, say, the Pogorelov estimate that I described last time to the UJs and show that you get it uniformly on compact subsets, you get an estimate for the second derivatives. Now, why doesn't the Pogorelov estimate work here? Well, let's suppose you try to do it. What's happening, because you're losing the boundary values somewhere, possibly, what's happening there, and the approximating problems are sort of, approximating solutions are looking something like that, you're getting the gradient becoming very large there. So you don't have control over the gradient. Okay? That by itself is not such a big problem, because if you remember, we needed to put in a cutoff function. We looked at a thing like this. We put in a cutoff function. You could use the solution I explained last time. You could use as a cutoff function V minus U, where this is zero in omega and has the right boundary condition. Okay. Now, you have to do something, because where this set is positive, the gradient of this function is not, of the UJs, is not uniformly bounded. So one thing you could possibly do is put in a delta there and take the positive part. So what that does is basically shift this function down, and by shifting down a bit, the idea is you've come, where the set is positive, you've come in a little way. And so on that slightly smaller subset, you would have the bounded gradient. Now, that doesn't work in this case. So to make this idea work, you would need to have a uniform modulus of continuity for the UJs. Because if you come down a bit, you want to know if you've moved in a certain distance inside. And that's really the same as asking for a modulus of continuity. And that's exactly what you don't have. So the Pogorelov estimate, although it's very useful and very good, in this case we can't apply it directly. So the whole problem now is you really have to understand what these solutions are doing at the boundary. You have to get, from these approximations, you have to get some sort of control on the limit, and then you can go and back and do the regularity theory. So let me describe very, you know, sort of a sketch what you do. The proof uses the measure theory to get control of the limit solutions. So we've got this interior measure. So what we do is we look at M is the set X, the boundary of the set XT in omega cross R, such that U of X is less than T. So the picture is like this. This is U. This is M. M is the boundary. So if we have some, it's like that, we add on some vertical bits, right? Yes? Well, I'm just saying, if V is any function, any convex solution which is less than phi on the boundary, less than or equal to, then V must lie below U. So U is the maximum solution. No, well, you can take equals. They might not, just less than or equal. As long as it's less than.
So, and that solution is
that's
part
of the
uniqueness.
Right, that.
Uniqueness is not complete
until
the end of that. Yeah, okay,
that makes sense. Maybe I didn't say satisfying this, and such that. Right, I didn't state it properly. Such that. Okay, that makes more sense now. Yes. Weekly. Well, you have to do some work. That takes some work. It's not completely obvious. I'm not going to give the proof of that today.
But actually, so let me take a stab at getting a proof. Instead of like the proof that I want to sketch is the following. Whenever a convex function converges, whenever a sequence of convex functions converges, it's also true that the derivative converges almost everywhere. you have a sequence of convex functions, the derivatives are increasing functions. Whenever you have a sequence of increasing functions,
Well, a proof of that statement it will be in the notes, actually. It's in the notes. Well, yes. Not the proof. What you need is that fact plus... They're Borel measures, which are finite on compact sets, so they're Radon measures. They have certain regularity properties. So the measure of a compact set is... or the measure of an open set is approximated by... from inside by the measures of compact sets, and measure of an arbitrary set is approximated from the outside by open sets. You need those facts a little bit as well. And you need the fact that a characterization of this as well, sort of what it does on compact sets. And
measures can be written as the image of this Gauss, not Gaussian, but algebraic thing under the gradient UN stars. And
sure,
so we
can make convergence. So, sure. Oh, of course, you have to use the regularity of the thing.
Yes.
To make this actually work, you need to eventually do something along with the
yeah, yeah. To do a proper, rigorous proof, you have to do it carefully, you have to use a little bit. But yes.
But
Okay, so the idea, the way to get control of what's happening at the boundary, where you lose the boundary values, it's a measure theoretic argument, actually. And so I look at, as well as this measure, so I get this convex set, I add these vertical pieces, here, right? And then I look at not just supporting planes inside, but they could be supporting planes to M, to the pink thing, at the boundary. So this gives, I call this measure, say, omega tilde, and it's defined in exactly the same way. Except that I've extended this subgradient not just to points inside but also to supporting surfaces of M, supporting planes. So you get an extension of this thing to the boundary, and then you can write that. That's the stuff that was on the interior plus the boundary stuff, which I'll write omega star. Okay? So yes. Yes. This is geometric stuff. Okay, so in the sense that if I put any Borel set here, this is E intersect omega, and this is E intersect boundary of omega for all Borel sets in the closure. Okay. And so we've got this theorem. So all of these, because I'm, well, what you can see is that this is always all of Rn, right? Because you can add all the possible, every hyperplane is supporting somewhere. So you get all of Rn here. So, but what you get is also that omega uj tildes converge weakly to omega u on omega bar. So that's this statement here without compact support.
Converge to omega bar or omega tildes?
omega tilde, sorry. And if it's basically the same argument as before. And what? Is it easy to see? Well, it's what Robert said. No, I'm not going to prove this. I'm just using these facts.
Right.
Well, you know, I mean, it's...
I mean, if you believe that the interior...
I don't know if you get it quite immediately from the interior one, but it's the same sort of proof. The fact that all these measures that have finite total mass helps a little bit. Okay. But what's important here is how the boundary measures behave under local uniform convergence. So if there exists some psi which is in, say, L1 of omega, such that, so this is, say, non-negative, such that omega uj of e is less than the integral of psi for all, say, Borel sets, e, and for all j, then omega star uj converges weakly to omega star u. Uj goes to U locally uniformly. Right? And that's important because I've only got local uniform convergence, but I'm getting something about the limit thing in a measure theoretic sense. And this condition here, that they're all sort of, the interior measures are all sort of controlled uniformly by an L1 function, is exactly the thing I have here, because they're all controlled by this K. So it's exactly the sort of, this is sort of made to deal with that sort of problem. What's the picture, you see? What this omega star is somehow, in a measure theoretic sense, it's measuring, you know, how big the how steep the graph is becoming at the boundary, right? But it does it in a way that you can pass to limits only even with just local uniform convergence. You don't need Lipschitz up to the boundary or a continuous up uniformly on the whole domain, just locally. That's important. So it gives you this measure theoretic way of sort of saying something about the graph at the boundary. Okay, so now we're sort of okay, so now we let x0 be a point on the boundary where u at x0, which I define to be the lim in as x goes to x0, the view of x, is strictly less than phi at x0. So that's a place where we lose the boundary values. So geometrically, what's happening? Let me draw the picture. The boundary value drops down, because this is u. The approximations are up here, like this, uj. That's what we would like to have. So what is happening here is that the graphs of the uj are getting very, very steep. Right? And you can convert that sort of idea into a statement about the measures. You can do a computation, which I don't particularly want to go through now, because I've forgotten how it goes completely, but that this is you can make that less than epsilon to the n. So you take so how can I draw this picture somehow? This is x0 here, and you take a sort of a ball here. This part of the boundary here, under this star thing, I mean, you prove this for the UJs, then you can pass to the limit using this result. You get the same estimate for the U. Right? That's exactly why I wanted this result. It allows me to pass to a limit just with this weak, this locally uniform convergence. So we've got that. And now I want to show, so what else do we know? Omega of u that's equal to, which is less than, say if k is bounded, it's less than a constant times epsilon to the n. And if k is whatever I said it was up there, integrable to some slightly better power than n, get 1 over q. N minus n over q. That's what I had, I guess. Like that. Okay, and finally, if this is not empty, that is, if there is a supporting plane here, then it has some finite slope, whatever. So if there is such a plane, then where this constant depends on the slope. So the slope here is p. And so if you put all this together, you see you've got epsilon to the n minus 1. Here you've got something bigger than n minus 1. This q is bigger than n, and here you've got epsilon to the n. So these two are supposed to add up to that. And of course, for epsilon small enough, you get a contradiction. So that says there is no plane like this. So the graph, the view, actually does become vertical there. That's the idea. Okay, now to prove these estimates, the first one, well, this one is obvious. This one, you really work with the UJs, because you know they're becoming very steep.
So, would you say that the boundary we will have boundary data attained everywhere?
No.
All of
them? No. No. Some places you'll have the right boundary condition, other places you won't. But where you don't, so where you lose the boundary data, right, the graph of the solution U has to become vertical. Okay? And this part here, this estimate here, basically, it's a sort of, you have to look at the Gauss map here, and you show that it contains a cone with aperture epsilon. Of order epsilon, so that and that gives you the, so the gradient image rather contains a cone. The gradient image of this set here, or the sub gradient image, contains this cone of all aperture has order epsilon, so that's where you get the epsilon to the end. And the vertex of the cone basically depends on the slope. So that gives you contradiction. So what you've got when you do all that, what you've got is where you lose the boundary values, the graph really does become vertical there. So the normal derivative really is infinite. Okay, so that now we can do the regularity theory. What we've got, where we've got the right boundary values, things are fine, and elsewhere it becomes vertical. So the next thing is, well, now we take a point inside, we take a supporting plane, and the claim is that this supporting plane can touch at most one point of the boundary of the graph. Now, it can't be one of these points where it's vertical, because it's vertical, it can't. So it can only, so you can have a line segment that runs out only if it runs out to a point where you have the right boundary values. Now, if there's only one such point, so this picture's not very good, if you... suppose you have there, it touches at only at one point on the boundary, and it's a supporting plane in here. You can sort of tilt it a little bit lower like this. It'll move away from that point at the boundary. Then you can lift it up a little bit. And what you do by doing that is you chop off a piece of the graph in here, near which contains the neighborhood of the point you're interested in, and on that subset you have affine boundary values. Right? And once you have affine boundary values, then, okay, the UJs, so they, this is a sort of a, also converging down, so they have affine boundary values on some slightly different. Right, it's at most a point, one point on the boundary. I'll explain why in a minute. Okay, let me start it again. Maybe I'll draw a bigger picture somewhere. I want to put it into a situation where I can apply the estimates to the approximating problem. So what we know now, so where we lose the boundary values, it's vertical, and where we don't lose them, well, we have the right boundary condition. Now, the claim is, if you take a supporting plane somewhere that to the graph, let's say here, let's call that x0. Well, I want to show there are no segments in the graph that go to the boundary in both directions. That's really what you need. And what it is, if you do have a segment that runs out to the boundary in both directions, it must hit where you have here, and you have the right boundary values there. So if you make a add on a linear function, basically you have u of x, and choose, say, this is the xn axis this way, what you have is along the, here you have right, because phi is smooth. So if you think of this as being in the xy plane, and this is the yeah, and it grows at most quadratically here, and by convexity, u is phi, and the boundary is smooth, so u at x, so, well, here u will be controlled from above by a quadratic thing like that, and here, same sort of thing. And so now you can look at ux equals some constant x prime squared plus some epsilon xn squared minus delta or something like that. And basically what you do is you bump it a little bit so that this goes below the line segment in the middle, say if the origin is here. But if you make this epsilon small, you will still have Gauss curve, not u, this would be u tilde. Gauss curvature of u tilde will be less than the Gauss curvature of u. And therefore, u tilde will have to be bigger than u, but at the center, at the origin, you get u tilde is minus epsilon delta, but u zero is zero, and you get a contradiction. So if you have, and you can do the same argument actually if you have it only at one end point, so then you'd sort of, you can make the same argument, as long as you keep away from the cone, the vertex. So anyway, so that... yeah. Okay, so what you achieve then is, so if you do it, you can do it just from one side, as long as if your segment doesn't run out to the boundary, you can also do it just from one side, and it's a little, you know, it's a little bit, you have to move in a bit, it's a bit more messy, it's a bit messier, but if, anyway, if you can show, once you show that there's at most one point of the boundary, you take a supporting plane here, it touches most one point there, you can tilt it a little bit. So you tilt it a little bit, it goes below, and you translate it upwards a little bit. And when you do that, what you've chopped off is a set U here, and in that set, U is on the boundary of that set, U is equal to some linear affine function. Okay, and the approximating problems, the UJs, they're converging. The UJs, there are corresponding pink set down here, UJ, on which UJ has affine boundary values. And these UJs, at least for J large enough, they all contain some fixed ball about x0. So now you can apply the Pogorelov estimate on these UJs and get the estimate, so then you Evans, Krylov, so on smaller sets, and then you get regularity in a neighborhood. Interior regularity. Okay. There's also a boundary regularity, but well, maybe I'll say something about that as well. So that's the proof of that theorem, basically. They don't need to do that, I think, because their equation, basically they've got an estimate that doesn't require affine boundaries. It works just with you know, sort of a standard cutoff function. Okay, but this sort of idea of showing that you can tilt a plane, move it up a bit, get affine boundary condition on some suitable subdomain, that's sort of one of the things that's used a lot in this theory, Monge-Ampere. Right, you can always subtract an affine function, make it zero. It's the same, essentially the same thing. Okay. So that's that theorem. Once you get C2, then you get all the higher regularity of K's smooth. Okay, so the next thing I want to describe is what happens when you go to the extremal case here. So what do you do? Well, now you've got in the extremal case, so think of a hemisphere, you solve and the boundary condition, well, you take something, say constants. Let's see, let me put one, rather than epsilon, 1 minus 1 over m, say. And you don't need to solve the Dirichlet problem. You can just use the theorem that I just erased where you lose the boundary values. It doesn't matter. Any convenient boundary condition that you know how to solve will do. Right? You just say, take constants here. And you choose the constants, so something you know how to solve. We know how to solve this, right? Because it's a little bit less than omega n here, right? So, and you choose the constants so that say at some point x0 inside is 0 for some fixed x0 in omega. Okay. So now the idea now is how are we going to get a limit out of this? You want to get a limit out. Now we can't rely on the boundary values because they might be going off to infinity, or we don't know what they're doing. So the idea is that you have a local bound, regardless of any boundary condition. And how does that come about? Well, if you integrate the Gauss curvature, but now you put in this factor, and this is still less than a constant, still finite, this power still decays like 1 over power to the n, plus 1, so it's still finite. And on this side, you estimate on any compact subset you take the minimum of k on any compact subset, and the assumption is k is positive, so this is some fixed number, lambda of omega prime, which is positive. It could be going to zero as you go out to the boundary, but it's fixed. So you have local area bound. Independent of, it depends only on a lower bound for k on that compact subset. And if you think about this a little bit, it sort of becomes intuitively clear. If you have an convex function and they have the graphs have bounded area, you sort of expect you're going to be able to get a convergent subsequence out of that. Well, you could probably even use, you know, weak. Convergence in W12 at this stage, right, and get out the weak limit. But you actually, once you have an area bound, you also have a local oscillation bound. If you go to a smaller subdomain, you actually get oscillation bounded. This is from convexity. And the proof of that, proof is not very hard. So let's assume that the inf of u is 0, and for t positive you look at the set A of t where u is bigger than t, and you look at the set B, t is the set where the gradient bigger than t. Okay, so now, so let's assume we've got the integral of the gradient is less than some constant m. We've got a bound like that. Then the measure of the set BT, it must be less than M over T, because if it wasn't, you would get a contradiction to this. And by convexity, the gradient on the set AT, where must be at least t times the diameter of omega, right? Because somewhere it's zero, and the set here where u is bigger than t, it must be at least, here it must have slope, at least the slope of that line, which is at most, which is at least t divided by the diameter. So you get that. So the diameter has to be large, is bounded, the gradient is grows like this. On the other hand, the set where gradient is bigger than t decays. So what does that tell you? Well, if you think about this, it tells you that the set AT is contained in the set BT over D. Where D is the diameter. And therefore, for T bigger than T0 equals 2m d over omega n epsilon n, A of T, because we have this and we have that, A of T must be less than a half omega n epsilon to the n. And what's the picture now? See? This is the set where U is bigger than T, so the level sets look something like that. This is the measure of the set here, and we have control on it like this. If you choose T bigger than this number, you get that. And so what does that say? Well, it's a convex set, so if you think about putting a ball here, it must contain half of, at least half of that ball, right? So the biggest ball you can put there, the ball you can put there can't have radius bigger than epsilon. So another way to say that is the distance of this point here to the boundary is at most epsilon. In other words, the level sets, the set where T is bigger than, where U is bigger than T, has to be within a certain neighborhood of the boundary, and that's a local oscillation now. So you do that here. You've got a local gradient bound. You use that argument. It gives you, on smaller subsets, you get a local oscillation bound. It depends on the distance between them. That doesn't matter. And so you apply this now to the approximating problems. On any compact subset, you've got to UJ. Okay, so now we've got the oscillation of UJ is less than some constant for all omega prime contained in omega. So we can pull out a subsequence. Well, I've set the inf to be zero, the minimum. Well, I mean, I can move up and down. I've just set it, so just for the sake of proving this little this should be stated as a little lemma. Now, I've said what this shows is that it must be, if you choose T in this way, then this set must be close to the boundary. And so locally, right, this set here, AT less than half omega n epsilon n, if it has that measure, it must be this implies that the distance of AT to the boundary is less than epsilon. And so if we stay epsilon away, everything that's epsilon away, on that set we have a bound, which you can get by untangling these numbers. Okay, so that's what we want to apply here. We apply it to the approximating problems. We have local oscillation estimate on any compact subdomain. We can pull out a convergent subsequence from this, and you get a solution to the limit problem. What happens, you don't know what happens at the boundary. You lose all information about the boundary, so then you have to recover some of that. What you do have is this. Which is omega u of omega, and this is equal to omega u of omega bar. So what you're in the same situation as before. The boundary measure is zero. And now you can use the same sort of argument to lift the planes and so on. And then you get regularity. So the theorem in this extremal case omega is, say, uniformly convex, say C infinity, say L, let's say L infinity, it doesn't matter, K positive, integral of K is omega n, then there exists a convex solution U, which is smooth in the interior of the equation, star, I called it. And U is unique up to constants. So I haven't proved the uniqueness part yet, but we've got the existence and the regularity, basically. So why do you get uniqueness? Suppose you have I'm going to carry out the uniqueness assuming I've got smooth solutions. You can actually do it for generalized solutions. There's some little technicalities you have to worry about. So suppose U and V are two convex solutions. And U minus V is not a constant. Then fix x0 such that in the domain such that du of x0 is not equal to dv of x0, okay? You can add by adding constant to say u, we can assume u at x0 is v at x0. So what we've got is the following picture. Remember, these solutions have infinite gradients. The boundary is one, here's another one. And we fix a point like this. And we look at, say, this set here where, say, let's say call this one U, this one's V. So here, U is the set where U is less than V. Okay, so first of all, if you take any supporting plane to V in there, you can translate it to get a parallel supporting plane. On the other hand, these in particular, if you do that with a supporting plane here, they have different gradients. So if you translate this one, you get parallel plane here at some point, say y0, and so d of u of y0 is going to be an interior point of du of u, but it's a boundary point of dv. I take this supporting plane here at the boundary. It's a tangent plane to V, graph V, but it's not a tangent plane to graph U because they have different gradients there. So I translate it until it does become. And that must be somewhere down here at some point y0 inside. Remember, these things are diffeomorphisms, right? Everything's smooth already. So it's an interior point of one of them. It's a boundary point of the other. On the other hand, what do we know? If you integrate this, so this one was contained in, so you get less than or equal to. On the other hand, because this is equal to the integral of k over u, this integral of k over u, you must have equality here. And now, these are two open sets. One has a boundary point, this is a boundary point of one, an interior point of the other. They must differ by some open set. So on the other hand, you can't have equality. You get a contradiction. This is this old argument of Aleksandrov. It works in the generalized solutions. You've just got more technicalities to worry about. So anyway, that gives you the uniqueness. Maybe I'll say a few words. What happens? Where it becomes vertical. Yes, go ahead.
Transporting k and x onto this thing, mm-hmm. The gradient u, and this thing I guess doesn't have second moments. The transportation cost from here to here is infinite if this lives on a bounded domain, which is mm-hmm. where we come in. In the case where the transportation cost for getting from here to here is infinity because the integral of this against y squared is infinity, but there's still a unique optimal, there's still a unique gradient of a convex function that does it for you.
Okay, let me come back to something that will let's take S and G in say L1 of Rn, let's say C2, you don't need that much. Positive. Okay. Then you can show that there exists a unique convex function U on Rn solving that. And you can do that. I used k and this function here before, but if you look at the arguments, you see the same thing's going to work. You can do it first on the compact, where this has compact support, and then you do an approximation argument, and so you get this result, unique up to constants, of course, and it's smooth. C2. So you can carry out this argument more generally. It's not special for Gauss curvature. The main point you need is that if you have this is integrable, then there exists some function phi from say 0 to infinity to say 1 infinity, strictly increasing, continuous, such that that is integrable. So if it's integrable, it's actually a little bit better. And that little bit better is really what, before when we squeeze that little bit out to get the area bound, you can squeeze that little bit out to get a bound whatever, about omega, and that's enough to make the argument go. So it's not special just for Gauss curvature. What I want to say next is special for Gauss curvature. So now let's say Gauss curvature is smooth, boundary omega smooth, uniformly convex, and we've got that the normal derivative of u, so d nu u, is infinity on some portion of the boundary. So that's exactly the situation we have in the extremal case, where it's infinite all around the boundary, or in the first theorem where it's infinite where you lose the boundary values. then u restricted to boundary, say gamma intersect B R over 4 is smooth, R over 2. So the picture, you have infinite normal derivative here, then you have, it's actually smooth there, and it's smooth, the graph is smooth as a submanifold. All the curvatures stay bounded up to the boundary there. Okay, positive. So that answers the regularity for where you lose the boundary values. So that's smooth and graph U over is a smooth submanifold with boundary. And maybe I'm going to sketch the proof of that in. Yes?
So you're going to take it on a smaller ball?
On a smaller ball, yes. If it's true everywhere, then you can cover the whole domain. And it's, say, in the extremal case, then it's true on the whole boundary. But if it's true only on a boundary portion, you have to shrink down a bit. But then you can cover it, right? You take smaller and smaller balls, but the estimates all blow up as you take smaller balls. I mean, I can take it to half ball, I can take it to three quarters, any, as long as it's smaller. I have to shrink down a bit. But that's true, anyway. So you get this regularity result even where you've got where you lose the boundary values but you've got infinite gradient. Maybe I can compare that with the minimal surface case. If you want to look at the minimal surface equation, one way is you try to minimize the area, and you don't know, if you're not going to put some curvature restrictions on the domain, you may not be able to solve the Dirichlet problem classically, so you can think about minimizing this functional for a reasonable sort of domain. And what happens is the same sort of thing. You can solve the Dirichlet problem. You can find a minimizer. It will have the right boundary values in some places and not in others. And what happens where you lose the boundary values, you get sort of infinite gradient there, and it's smooth trace and so on. So it's the same sort of theorem, but completely different techniques.
So basically, at this point, you can think that the surface basically rips, that you have to tear it. It tears it, that
the boundary. Well, it's sort of detaches. I mean, the approximating solutions converge to part of this vertical cylinder. Yes.
As a graph over the boundary.
Yes.
Then it rips right at the point where it's smooth on the interior where you have the infinite slope, right?
Yes.
And then where it's longer, this.
We don't know.
In
general, it doesn't. It's like K is positive everywhere. Then you've got, you do have some global regularity. You still get continuity up to the boundary. But what happens, and if I can somehow draw a picture, is you might have the boundary values somewhere and then it drops down below. Right? Now, where it leaves the boundary values, it's a nice smooth manifold here. But what happens at this transition, where just on the boundary, we don't know yet. In this case, it's least phi alpha, for some alpha. But whether this is a smooth, stays smooth across that point, or there's some sort of jump, that we don't know that. Well, this boundary manifold here, maybe it only has, I don't know what the regularity of the boundary is, maybe it's only Lipschitz or Hölder continuous, that's the best we know. It's not necessarily C1, C2, whatever. Okay, but I think it's a very hard problem to work that out. But if I can take 5 minutes, I can sort of explain to you how you do this. So, the obvious thing is that it's becoming vertical here. You might as well think about writing it as a graph over the vertical plane near here. And when you do that, if you represent this, say, the boundary, at least locally, by as graph psi in the new coordinates, what you have is, let's call the new function, say v, is k, now it becomes, say, y, and it's going to depend on v, say, 1 plus dv squared, n plus 2 over 2, in some set. Well, let's say B, R intersect the set where B is bigger than psi. So the picture is like this. So here B is equal to psi, and here B is bigger than psi. Psi is the sort of the boundary represented as a graph. And so what you've got two boundary conditions. You've got V equal psi on the boundary of this set. And the normal, or dn, V is equal to zero on that set. So you've got two boundary conditions, and now you want to, but you don't know what that boundary is, right? That's sort of this place where you've lost the boundary values. All you know is it's vertical there, so that translates to this. So you've got a free boundary problem. And then you have to study the regularity of this free boundary problem. So instead of writing it as a graph over this way, I've written it as a graph over a vertical tangent plane. So, right, it's still prescribed Gauss curvature, that doesn't matter. It's just that instead of being dependent just on x1 up to xn, it will be dependent now on... I mean, that's it, really. I mean, Gauss curvature is invariant. You make a rotation. The Gauss curvature here, whether you write it as a graph here or as a graph this way, it's going to be the same. Just that the arguments are going to be different coordinates. So you see, this is sort of special to Gauss curvature. Okay, and then you have to study this free boundary problem. And how do you, how do psi is represent the y n plus 1 is this way, y 1 up to y n is here. So the boundary here, boundary omega cross r, is graph psi, at least locally, right? Here. And so we've got this free boundary problem. Now you have to study the regularity of that, and then you need quite a few estimates for that. But the yeah.
So we have to unroll, well, not unroll, but map it the boundary, so it's you become, and it becomes a graph.
Yeah, but it's if I stay in a small neighborhood here, the graph here is going to be a graph over the vertical plane as well. And I
have.
But I'm only interested in a graph over part.
The
plane is. And I will work in a small neighborhood. And in fact, before I do this, I get various estimates on the graph that give me sort of control. Basically, a modulus of continuity for the normal vector field at the boundary. So it gives me an estimate of how big this thing is. And a sort of an opposite of that, which is sort of a strict convexity estimate for the graph there, which tells me how big the gradient image of this is going to be. You've got to get quite a few some fairly technical estimates before you do this. But once you do that, you've got this free boundary problem. And, well, you do the usual thing then. Legendre transform it. You get when you Legendre transform this, you get some, let's say Z, V star, D, V star. Now it's not going to look like Gauss curvature anymore because the gradient dependence is going to go into there. So let's just call it. But this is basically in a half ball. And we've got V star is psi star on the flat part, on and you've got, and now you study the regularity of this problem with a flat boundary portion. Okay. You do that, use all the Monge-Ampère theory, you get regularity, you get estimates, and you go backwards.
So
yeah, that's sort of typical thing you do in free boundary problems.
Boundary field boundary by doing this.
Yes.